Human interaction is the whole essence of this collaborative creative community, and these AI tools just, they're not being taught that part of it. I mean, they're able to give you results, don't get me wrong, but that collaboration is just so essential.
Hey, it's Zach here, and super quick before we dive into the show. If you haven't already, I want to make sure that you have subscribed to my free weekly Case of the Mondays newsletter, because it is where I share my best advice, strategies, and mindsets to help you design a creative career that you absolutely love showing up for every Monday morning. When you sign up, I'll even send you a bonus 5-day email course to help you clarify and prioritize the next small steps in your unique path to success. To sign up, just visit optimizeyourself.me/newsletter. All right, on to today's episode. My name is Zach Arnold, and I'm a former Hollywood film and television editor turned career strategist and the creator of Optimize Yourself, where I help artists, creatives, and storytellers just like you design the more balanced, more sustainable, and more fulfilling creative career that you deserve. In a nutshell, I'm Tim Ferriss meets Ted Lasso, minus the mustache, because I am obsessed with both learning everything I can about optimizing human potential while also inspiring you to realize yours. If you are ready to step outside your comfort zone, let's dive right in and unlock the optimized version of you. Hello, and welcome to the Optimize Yourself podcast, where I share honest and candid conversations with best-selling authors, world-class athletes, Hollywood legends, elite experts in a variety of fields, as well as everyday people that are achieving extraordinary things. It means the world to me that with all the podcast choices out there, you have chosen to invest your valuable time, energy, and attention with me. Now, before we get started, don't forget to visit optimizeyourself.me/podcast so you can subscribe, leave a review, and so you can also download your unique customized podcast playlist, where I'm going to send you the 5 best expert interviews from our archives to help you achieve your specific goals. So on that note, today I'm sharing something a little different with you. Last September, I was asked by the American Cinema Editors, or ACE for short, to speak on a panel for Edit Fest Global, where we debated the very hot topic of artificial intelligence and how it could potentially impact the art of editing. This is an emerging and rapidly developing area of technology that is clearly stirring up a lot of fear, excitement, and heated debates among creative professionals in a variety of fields. On the panel with me were ACE editor John Dudkowski, director, producer, and now OpenAI creative specialist Chad Nelson, who, by the way, was also recently a podcast guest as well, and co-founder and CEO of Runway, Cristobal Valenzuela. The panel was moderated by The Hollywood Reporter's tech editor, Carolyn Giardina. So without further ado, let's get to the ACE EditFest Global panel on artificial intelligence, technology, and exploring the impact on the art of editing.
I'm pleased to introduce the artificial intelligence panel from EditFest LA.
Please welcome our moderator extraordinaire, the tech editor at The Hollywood Reporter, Carolyn Giardina, and our panelists, Zach Arnold, ACE, John Dudkowski, ACE, creative collaborator with OpenAI, Chad Nelson, and co-founder and CEO of Runway ML, Cristobal Valenzuela. Take it away, Carolyn.
How's everybody's day going? Well, we are very excited to be here to talk about AI and editing today. And thanks to ACE for putting this together, especially the incomparable Jenny McCormick. So we had some introductions already, but seated next to me is Zach. And then we have John, Chad, and on the end is Chris, so you know who's who. So AI is not new, but with, of course, the conversations surrounding the strikes, this has become a topic that's raised a lot of questions, started a lot of conversations, and certainly concerns about the future of jobs. So hopefully during this session, we'll help educate you and give you a lot of information about it as everybody proceeds forward. This is really a collision of business, technology, and creative issues. But I think a good way to start, again, is to just focus on generative AI, which is really what's caused this this explosion. Chris, you were going to give a little generative AI 101 for us. Go ahead.
I'll try. That's a good question, I guess. But yeah, I'll start first of all with what you just said around AI not being new. This is, AI has been around for 80 years or so. It's only now that we're starting to see a new wave of models and technologies really developed and become a bit more mainstream, specifically a subfield of artificial intelligence called generative AI. Because there's other types of AI that you all and we all use every day when you Spotify or Netflix or any streaming service or recommendation algorithm, it's an AI system behind the scenes. Generative AI is it's new in the sense that it's getting better and more effective at doing not only understanding the world, which is what algorithms used to do before, but generating things in the world. And that could be language, audio, video, images. At the core, these algorithms are just math. It's a probabilistic, it's a statistical a model that tries to predict a certain pattern in data. And what we're seeing right now is a boom and an explosion in the quality of how these algorithms work. But it's really important to remember that these are tools. These are algorithms that don't have a goal, an intention, a system. They don't behave and act on their own. They're tools. And these tools are getting really good.
And probably the area that at least has been having active conversations about AI the longest is the visual effects community. I mean, if you look back two decades ago when Lord of the Rings came out, if you remember the big battles with the, you know, enormous orc armies, those were created with the assistance of AI. And more recently, a lot of tools that are used in, including, you know, Adobe's Premiere have AI tools within them. And we're going to be seeing a lot more. For example, there's work being done to make ray tracing faster so that you can do real-time virtual production and things like that. So you're going to be starting to see that. But today, we're going to focus on what it means to all of you. So what I wanted to do is to start with Zach and John. Would each of you just, you know, kind of, you know, set the stage about what you've both been paying a lot of attention to this and, you know, what your current feelings are on it?
Sure. So the first thing that I'll start with is that if the expectation is that I'm on this panel as an AI expert, I have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about right now. And anybody that calls themselves an AI expert and they know where it's going next, it's like asking a dog to do calculus. They have absolutely no idea what's going to happen next, including the people that have created all of this new technology. So I wanted to come at it from the perspective of I don't have the answers, I don't know where we're going next, but my perspective is not so much from the technology and the apps and the tools. My specific aim is to help us understand what makes us human, what makes us creatives, and what sets us apart from the machines. And what I've seen over the last several months in the work that I'm doing with all the students in my Optimizer program is them realizing that the fact that they have very specialized singular skill sets is going to put them at risk. So the reason today and the reason everybody's been asking me, why am I carrying around a 2002 Thomas guide at an editor's panel? How many of you even know what the heck this is? Hey, I'm not as old as I thought I was. Now we're going to date me. How many of you actually owned one of these and used it? Ooh, okay, so it's more than I thought. So if in 2002, and this one is very meaningful to me because this was when I moved to LA, for those that don't know, this is Google Maps to get around Los Angeles so you don't get lost. In 2002, if your business model was I sell paper versions of Thomas guides, do you think you're still in business? Probably not. However, what if your business model is I get people in Los Angeles from point A to point B with the smallest amount of confusion possible, and I make their journey better? If you pivot, can you still be in business today? That's what I specialize in, is helping you understand what is the narrative of the value that I truly bring to my craft, because my belief is that over the next 3 to 5 years, and I've now had this backed up from multiple economists and experts in a multitude of industries beyond entertainment, on my podcast, they've all said the following, and one person just told me last week, 5% or less of specialized careers are going to survive AI. So what we're seeing is the transition from specialization in our economy to generalization. And I always correct that saying it's back to generalization because we were a generalized society for most of human civilization. Then all of a sudden the Industrial Revolution comes along and for the sake of efficiency, we all became widgets on the assembly line of somebody else's dreams. That model is going away, and AI is going to start replacing highly specialized skill sets. So if it's a matter of what are the tools I need to learn, what does this do, what does that do, that's what these guys are for. I come from it, come at it from the perspective of how do we separate ourselves from the machines, and what are the human skills that are going to make us irreplaceable creatives.
There you go.
I
wish I had brought a prop.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry I didn't prepare you.
Yeah, I was very, very smart. So I'm also not an expert on AI. I can claim to be somebody who has been really passionately fascinated with artificial intelligence for a couple of decades. I remember my first spark of inspiration came from Ray Kurzweil's, you know, The Age of Spiritual Machines, which I think I picked up in like 1998. And there's a premise in that book, which is that while we can't predict the future, as Zach says, what we can predict is what we would do if we had enough computing power. If Moore's law is a law, what would we do with enough computing power? And that's the premise of this book. I don't know, raise your hand if you've read any Ray Kurzweil. Okay, there's a couple of people. I think he's a fascinating guy. He's a little odd, and some of his theories are kind of out there. But that simple premise, I think, opens up a lot of doors. I've been interested in science fiction, and it's really been a passion of mine for a long time. And then I was at a lecture at USC about 7 or 8 years ago, and there was a professor named Norm Holland, a member of ACE. And Norm gave a lecture about machine learning and artificial intelligence used in the cutting room, and how what was some of the cutting edge work being done in laboratories around the U.S. at that time, and he showed a demo of some students at Stanford, I think, who had built a. We've always joked about auto edit. But they were building a machine learning system for cutting scripted dialogue scenes. It used facial recognition and audio recognition, and it would use existing tropes for editing, and it would build out a scene, and it would do what would take an editor 3 hours to get the cut to the point where you could then start to do the refining process. And the machine did it in like 8 seconds. And, you know, Norm said, this is something that they're doing now. This is something that's on deck. And that blew my mind. Because the Ray Kurzweil science fiction theory stuff suddenly intersected directly with my my career and my passion, which is filmmaking. And then he also had another step in that same lecture. And I'm paraphrasing. And Norm passed away a few years ago, and the world is a sadder place without him. But I think he'd let me paraphrase a bit in this instance. The technology that we were looking at was based on facial recognition for video clips. But he said, what happens when we turn the camera around and the device you're holding is recognizing the face of the viewer? And you've got an algorithm that is building something on the fly, and it begins using the same facial recognition processes that tell it whether or not somebody's happy or sad or excited or whatnot. And you start using... biofeedback to train the algorithm to give the audience exactly what it is they want. As an editor, he started by blowing my mind, and then he took the scraps and what was left, and he just set them all on fire. This has been a really fascinating subject of mine for a long time. And then a couple of years ago, I was painting a bench at my kid's elementary school, and I started talking to another dad, and he was a visiting professor at USC, and I was like, I do a little teaching at USC, and he was a doctorate in he runs the neuroscience and artificial intelligence lab at the University of Montreal, and we decided to put together an event talking about using his contacts at the engineering school and my contacts at the film school. We decided to put together an event. To talk about the intersection of AI and filmmaking. And that was about 18 months ago. And the subject of AI and generative intelligence has become very hot in those 18 months. It was serendipitous, I guess. And that's actually how I came to know Chad. And through Chad, I came to know what Chris is doing. I don't have all the answers. I don't know specifics. I do have some theories, and I know the questions that I've been asking, and I can tell you what has been resonating with me and what I see, where I see things stand now, and I can tell you what concerns I have and what excites me. It's pretty radical stuff. I guess in a phone call we all had a few days ago, I said, I like to surf. That's like my hobby, the way I keep my head straight. And I think personally that artificial intelligence is a wave that we're all watching coming towards us. And we're all just sitting in the lineup seeing this wave come. And the only thing I know to do when I see a wave is to begin to paddle and to try to get into position, so see if I can surf it. And so all of these conversations, all of these discussions are all about figuring out how to be in position to surf this wave. I don't know how big it's going to be. It might not be surfable, but if it is, I sure as hell am going to try.
So. And thank you for bringing up Norm. He's the first editor that I spoke with about AI as well.
Yeah.
He was way ahead.
He's a really inspiring guy, yeah.
Yes. So again, there are a lot of tools out there now that are using AI to varying degrees and for various purposes, and more are being developed. So as an example, Chris, would you like to take over and tell us a little bit about what your company is doing?
Yeah, for sure. So Runway is a company that's now turning 5 years. I've been working on the idea of Runway almost for 8 years now. What we do is we do fundamental research in the field of generative AI and artificial intelligence to come up with new tools for human expression. That's how we like to think about it. And so really thinking about creation and editing and automation of everything that would allow you to take ideas from your head into real pieces of film or content in the shortest amount of time possible. So pretty much like the guide here, instead of having the guide physically, it would be great if you could just have a version of that guy in a much more digital version that's much cheaper and easier to go around. That's how we think about the tools that we do. We're building a system that will replace traditional, more time-consuming processes and make them much more convenient and easy and expressive to use. We've made some algorithms on image generation. So if you hear about latent diffusion or stable diffusion, and then more recently for video generation that I think some of you guys were using for creating videos of Gen 1 and Gen 2. Those are the models that we've released more recently. We've been working this for some time now.
And just to give this a little bit of context for the editors and the audience who currently have their, you know, editing system of choice that they use, is this a tool that augments that work or and works alongside of it? Do you have to replace something? Could you just give us a little sense of the workflow?
So it's a tool that augments workflows. So there's tools on the automation side of things. For rotoscoping, for example, we have a tool called Green Screen that can segment and do rotoscoping in just a few seconds. And so a lot of editors use that alongside traditional NLEs or compositing software. We have tools for inpainting that allows you to remove wires on objects within shots. And we have tools that allow you to generate videos. So think about it as the best way to think about really AI these days, I like to think about it as a new kind of camera. This is a camera. And the way you use the camera really matters. And so the camera can be used in all sorts of different ways in combination with existing workflows, like a lot of editors are using it these days. And so right now it's a tool that enhances that process of editing or creating a film or a short film or a video.
And again, they're all cloud-based tools.
This is all cloud-based. The one challenging thing around AI these days is that it's very compute intense. And so you need a lot of computing power to be able to run these models at the speeds of that you require. And so we have a supercomputer in the cloud that allows you to run these models fast enough. And so you don't have to have a supercomputer in your house.
And to give us a little bit of a sense of, again, this is developing so quickly in this space right now. Where are you going? Could you give us a little sense of your roadmap?
Sure. Without going too much into details, a lot has happened over, the last 12 months. But again, AI is not new as a field. It's been there for years and decades. Over the last 12 months, we've seen an explosion of new models and new qualities and new overall results in every domain, in every modality, from language to images to video. Right now, we're entering, I would say, the first phase of video models. And so it's good to remember that there are different domains in AI. There's language models. And when you hear about LLMs, which I think a lot of people have heard, you know, people might have used, or you, maybe some here have heard of use language models and chatbots, that's a particular domain and type of artificial intelligence. There's others, so image is another one, or video is another one. There are models that can do a bit of everything. And so really what we're working on is pushing forward video as one of those modalities that can continue to achieve great results. And then going deeper into, I would say, two things. Control. These are tools. And tools become really useful the moment you can control them. Right now, you can generate video. If you haven't tried it, try it. It's phenomenal. It's really interesting. I think we're discussing how it ended. You can generate video using words. You can generate video using images. But really, to get to the next level, you need to be able to control it in the same way that you can control a camera. You can move the camera around. You can go from the side. You can change the lens. You can change the camera you're using depending on the situation. That kind of like really matters for us. And then the next stage of I would say, roadmap for us or improvements are on this idea of multimodal systems. So think about when you watch a movie, you're watching, it's a multisensorial experience. You're watching the movie, there's sound, there's text. You're seeing all of those things at the same time. Creative software should work in the same way. It should allow you to communicate with the software with words, with verbal communication, with text. And the AI, the system, should be able to transfer your intentions into not just audio and videos and images, but a cohesive narrative. And that's where we're still not there yet, but a lot of it will be to push the boundaries of multimodalities.
Chad, we're going to get to you now. Yeah. You recently created an animated short using DALL-E. So for starters, why don't you explain the technology and then we can get into the short.
Sure. So I work a lot with OpenAI, and I think everyone now has probably heard of that company through the release of ChatGPT or GPT-4. And last year in April, they announced a text-to-image system. So just like Chris was talking about, you can basically type in a thought, if you will, or a prompt, as they like to call it, and it would generate an image. So they had, you know, examples in the beginning days would be like, oh, I want an avocado chair, or I want a chipmunk riding a skateboard in Central Park, and it would deliver that image. And when I saw that, it was very fascinating to me because I'm a creative director, so my whole business is about not only thinking of ideas, but then how to sell those ideas, how to actually pitch and present and actually go from that light bulb in your head to a final piece of finished work. And when I saw this, it made me say to myself, I think this might be the first tool that I've seen where it has changed the way I think about conceiving ideas as opposed to executing finished work. And that was where I wrote them. Literally, I wrote OpenAI cold and said, hey, if I were a person, like if I worked for, say, Disney, and I was representing Star Wars or Marvel and the entire universe, and this system was trained on my full library of all my planets and characters and wardrobe and all this, how quickly could I envision my world? And so basically, because of that email, they said, well, we'd love for you to see what you think. And so what I did is they gave me access to DALL-E, about April, like I said, of last year. And I played with it for about 8 hours straight, just creating things, just like architecture and locations, characters, and so forth. And what I found is that it made me realize that this is a tool that lets me essentially ideate in execution level kind of quality. And it changed the way I think about just presentation, conceptualization. And even when we think about, like, the last presentation, talking about all the previs, like the previs now could start to really look like close to final work. I mean, and that's what Runway allows. I think there's one story before I go into Critters. Like, John recently asked me as a little case study, he's like, hey, well, I don't remember exactly what it was for, but it was like, I need like an LED mountainscape, like a little 3D, like, you know, classic green screen kind of like LED landscape, like it's on a computer screen. How quickly can you do that? So I went into Runway, into Gen 2, and I typed up a description. About 3 minutes later, I had a couple of different options, and then I sent them to John. John's like, yeah, that would be a week of discussion, meetings, previs, and then work. And we just whipped something out in a matter of minutes, just on a phone call, basically. And that, to me, is where this really was so radical. So if I fast forward, in September of last year, so about a year ago,
I said to OpenAI, I think we can make a movie with DALL-E. I mean, just literally taking all these visuals and now taking traditional tools, Premiere, After Effects, and so forth, and then also utilizing the Unreal Engine, I think we could actually make a short film. And this was fascinating. They said, well, how quickly could you do it? Because if we would do this, we want it to be the first movie made with AI. So they gave me a week to basically say, and so I had nothing. And they said, well, what's your idea? And so I pitched them. I said, well, I have this idea for like a David Attenborough's Planet Earth colliding with a Monty Python sketch where all the animals start talking back to the narrator. They're like, oh, that's great. When can you actually show us something? And so normally in this, you know, in this business, you would probably go in with a script and maybe a couple of boards. I went back to him a week later with the film. Now, it wasn't fully animated, and I didn't have any voice actors. I just used myself. But I showed them the movie, the five-minute movie, and it was still a little rough around the edges. And they're like, great, let's fund this. Actually, the longest part of the process was actually getting the actors to agree to do it for OpenAI because they were so nervous about getting the, you know, Open might train a model on their voices, on their talents' voices. So anyway, we made this film. We launched it. It's now on the short, like the film festival circuit. And it's really interesting to see the response because one of the debates we had was, do we put at the opening titles like OpenAI Presents, or do we just let people walk into this film? And we chose essentially to put that not at the beginning, but at the end. And I think that's where it's been very fascinating because when I see the response and I see people's reactions who don't know, then they see that, oh wow, the AI was involved in this. And then it all of a sudden starts a conversation about real curiosity and intrigue about, well, how did you use the AI? What did it benefit it? Or how did it benefit your process? Or how much shorter was it because of this? So I think we'll take a look at a clip, I think.
Yes, and then we'll talk about it. Could we play the clip, please?
I'm David Attenborough's neighbor, Dennis, and welcome to a forest filled with little critters. Our first encounter is this curious fellow with the eyes of a hawk and the ears of a bat. He stands guard for the many creatures of these woods. Now, this astonishing creature is thankful for the lookout, for it sleeps 23.6 hours a day. Specific, I know, but witnessing their subconscious adventures is truly adorable. Looking upward, we find the red jackal spider. It's hairy, distinctive for its...
Excuse me.
Wait, I'm sorry, who is speaking?
I'm speaking to you.
Oh dear, I've eaten the wrong berries.
Nope, it ain't the berries.
What? Who are you?
I'm Frank.
And I'm Blue, which is weird, because I'm a red spider.
I cannot call you Frank or Blue. This is a science documentary.
Science? Ha! You think secretly filming someone while they sleep is science?
Why, yes.
Why, no. It's creepy.
So creepy.
Listen, I can assure you I'm here as an award-winning documentarian, behest by His Majesty.
Oh, so you're an English colonialist?
No, we're not here to colonize.
Right. Pretty soon you'll have us talking all dainty, drinking tea and...
Oh, not me. I prefer coffee.
Yeah, me too.
Me three.
Ooh, we should do a coffee run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please, I just need you all to be mysterious little critters.
What? Little?
Ugh. My therapist warned me about people like you. You just love to label.
Your therapist?
Yeah. What'd you say? He was the guardian of the woods?
Yes.
See, it's tough being a red spider.
Mm-hmm.
So many expectations.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Good. So what's funny about that is I watched that now and it's a year old. So in AI terms, that's like 10 years old. Like, it's just like, it just shows you like, we basically, all that was created by just typing in descriptions. And then I would, DALL-E at the time you could do, or you still can, but you could go into areas and say, really modify the character. So you could choose the eyes, you could change the backgrounds. It wasn't like just one and done, push a button and it makes it. It was very much like having just, it's a tool. And really it's about how quickly can I get those thoughts of, oh, what does this character might look like? Or how does it move? Or what's the background? Where is it inhabiting? Just how quickly can I generate that? And that's what I found was so fascinating with this process.
My sincerest apologies for the interruption, but if you're a creative professional who spends long hours at your workstation, not only is the following promo not an interruption, but listening has the potential to change your life. Because working with a topo mat underneath you at a height-adjustable workstation is a game changer. Let's learn a little bit more from Ergo Driven co-founder and CEO Kit Perkins, creator of the topo mat.
The topo mat is the first anti-fatigue mat designed specifically for standing desks. The real benefit of a standing desk is movement. We found bringing in this cushioned terrain under your feet, your brain just subconsciously engages and you wander around and you get that movement at the standing desk that you need without even having to think about it at all.
People will come to me at an event or a panel and they'll say, I got the topo mat because of you. Even when they had a mat, once they used this one, it was a total game changer.
We've just heard time and time again that with topo, we've kind of hit the sweet spot that it's the right premium quality materials and a right shape that people are actually getting benefit out of this stuff.
You spend more time here than anywhere if you do creative work the way that I do. So I would rather be driving around in a Ferrari than a Ford Pinto. And I feel like this is the Ferrari of the standing mat.
One of the things you don't realize is that at a standing desk, your main interface to the world, your body's main interface to the world is the ground. If you're going to invest in anything at that Ferrari level, it should be what you're standing on.
Well, my goal is that for anybody that is a creative professional like myself that's stuck in front of a computer for inordinate amounts of time of their waking life, they're doing it standing on a topo mat. So you and I, my friend, one edit station at a time are going to change the world.
I like it. That's a utopian vision I can get on board with.
If you're a creative professional looking for a simple and affordable way to stay active, energetic, and focused while spending long hours at your height-adjustable workstation, I can't stress enough how important it is to have the right mat underneath you, which is why I continue to share the topo mat as my number one product recommendation. To learn more about the topo mat and purchase yours, visit optimizeyourself.me/topo. That's T-O-P-O.
So Chad, I think a lot of us would be interested to hear a little bit more about the impact on the workers. What actually was done in AI? I know it's not DALL-E isn't an animation program, yeah. So where does the animation work fit in? And importantly, I think you were the editor, but tell us about editorial.
Yeah, I mean, so that was, again, what was so fascinating because I showed an animatic of the whole film, like I said, a week after, you know, kind of coming up and with the script and so forth. And what I showed was essentially DALL-E generation, so it looks like finished work. It wasn't just a storyboard sketch or it wasn't primitive 3D geometry. It looked like the finished film. So from the moment, in this case, the client, I guess you could say, OpenAI first saw an image, it was what it ultimately looked like, which again was a very fascinating way of selling or getting approval on a project. As for editing, what I did is essentially like you would any animatic, you'd lay it out and you block it out and you're doing all the voice acting and you get to a cut. And then what I found when I actually worked with the voice actors and got all their takes and essentially started replacing my dialogue, subtle changes, but it still kind of retained the original cut. So to me, it was just an interesting process where you're thinking about the edit even as you're writing it, even as you're creating it, which I think is always a fascinating thing as opposed to just being handed footage, but being a part of that process from the very inception, again, was a very big change for me personally in this.
Well, you said the biggest change you found was in pre-production, but would you elaborate on what was different in post-production?
In post, I mean, we still used After Effects. All those backgrounds were cut up and rotoed and animated traditionally in After Effects. And then Unreal Engine, if any of you have seen any work or performance capture through that, and I know some, I think some people have done it with some of the Star Wars properties and so forth. But it's, that was all, I mean, the AI kind of stopped once we got to the visuals. Everything else was I would call it, you know, traditional digital post-production and or production right now. I mean, we use facial capture. Most of that was, again, freeware software that you can just download integrated with Unreal. So our goal wasn't to replace the human effort of what it, all those traditional techniques that productions use. We wanted to deploy those, but how we conceived it and how we got to that point was where the AI really gave us the assist.
And as we've been saying, this is moving lightning fast.
Yeah.
And this was done a year ago.
Yeah.
So had you made this today, what would have been different?
Well, this is where, I mean, it's so funny because text to video and or take even text to image and then image to video is kind of the latest playground. And that's where I'm, you know, my role in this industry, if you will, is to basically say, well, there's a lot of demos out there, but how can we show, or what can we make that's truly watchable? What's production quality or production, like a real example or a case study? And to me, that is where I'm looking at now, and I'm not announcing anything, but I can say is like, we're definitely playing with, we're text to image and then image to video, using tools like what Chris has developed is, I think, kind of the next forefront.
Zach, John, I'm sure you have questions.
I personally have many. What I'm curious about coming at it from the perspective of kind of workflow, especially I think going off of what you said about it being the vast difference between a year ago and now, what you're going to say is going to be obsolete by the time we're all talking after the conversation that we have today. But it seems to me that now it's as simple as you can go into ChatGPT, you can say, write me a 3-minute short with the following characters. There's a red spider, there's a blue monster, and the voice of David Attenborough, he's narrating and they start talking back to him. Mm-hmm. It gives you the script. You then import into something like Runway DALL-E. I know that's a little bit more complex than that, but just to help me understand, because I'm still learning and I think everybody else is, how close are we to, you can pair all these together and you've all but eliminated the writer, you've definitely eliminated storyboard artists, you've definitely eliminated somebody that has the ability to do the animations. What parts of the process could you do now, and where can you basically skip over?
So Critters was interesting because ChatGPT hadn't been released and they only had GPT-4 available to the public then. I get lucky that I can play with some of the new models. I did not use it to create or write anything with Critters, GPT-4 that is, because I found it was far more interesting to improv and act and play. I think human play and human creativity is what brings a lot of the life and the spark to entertainment, where we also create that connection. And I found, and I did that experiment. I said, great, GPT-4 is out. Let's try to have it create a Critters and let's see how good it is. And the reality is it came up with some pretty funny lines. There is every once in a while a gem, but it is a slot machine pool. And it also doesn't know if it's made anything brilliant or if it's made literally, you know, something completely mundane. It has no idea. So you still have to curate it. I do think what's interesting about this world is in the command N of my entire career, it's always been a blank slate. There's always a white page or a white Photoshop image. And in this new world, when I hit command N, it will probably be something presented to me that I'm starting from and never starting at blank. Now, I think there will always be people that will still want to start at that blank page. And I think there's some merit to that, obviously. But I think it's interesting, this new technological wave, as you refer to it, John, is that blank page, I mean, once this is integrated into Microsoft Office and the entire Adobe Creative Suite, opening a Photoshop file might actually be intelligent enough to know that I'm working on this project for this Star Trek series, that it might actually start to generate things for me based on knowing what I'm already working on. And I think it's going to be very fascinating to see what emerges from that.
Can I dive in? Yeah.
Riffing on that, the event, we had this event at USC earlier this year, and it was, again, it was the engineering school and the film school, and there was some interesting takeaways, and that actually was part of the reason that I guess I'm sitting here now is because I talked to Jenny about it and was like, here, I think Ace should be talking about this. And it turns out there's a lot of other people with the same idea at the same time. As an editor and as a filmmaker, there's a responsibility to go down all the paths. And I'm paraphrasing a friend of mine who's in the audience right now. There's an editor out there named Tim Good, who is up for an Emmy for The Last of Us, by the way, if you guys are all voters. Little plug there, Tim. He's an old friend of mine, and he's really a remarkable guy and a brilliant editor. But he actually, I think, was one of the first people to articulate that idea to me, which was that part of the editor's job is to pursue all the different paths. You got to go down the path. You get notes, you get a scene, you got to explore all the different avenues, and that is part of the job. And you can't take shortcuts. You can't say, oh, I'm going to just jump to what I think the right version of the scene is going to be, or at least it should be generally discouraged, because a lot of times it's the discovery that you make along the way. Right now, the tools like Gen 2, what Adobe's making, ChatGPT. There's a lot of really interesting generative AI tools out right now that are allowing you to go down a path faster and are opening up new paths. Like for example, like using Gen 2, actually. So Runway's Gen 2 is really incredible stuff, and you got to go check it out. When Chad introduced me to it, one of the first things I thought of as an editor is, could I use this software to, it's not unusual that I've, you know, I'm cutting a dialogue scene or I'm cutting a scene and the producers decide that maybe we like the beginning of the scene and we like the end of the scene and everything in the middle, we'd love it, we could just take it out, you know? And maybe you've got a bunch of characters that are walking around a room and so continuity has just been blown to hell. And it's not unusual to find yourself in that position or at least I found myself in that position, and a lot of times the only way to get around that is with an insert shot or with some piece of footage that you can use to reestablish the geography of a scene. And, you know, the director a lot of times shoots what's on the page and what's in their head, and a lot of times aren't necessarily thinking, what if they destroy my scene completely and only use a piece of it and try to stick it onto this other piece and make it a Frankenstein, you know? So I thought of Runway Gen 2, and I said, could you use Runway Gen 2 to create an insert shot, you know? Could I use it to create a, you know, again, I work in a lot of science fiction, so could I use it to make a, you know, a hybrid fish hand touching a computer panel and a red light goes on, right? I, as an editor, could use that to then pitch that sort of an insert shot. I could build the scene and I could use that insert shot in such a way and I could tie it into my sequence, and whether or not it is airable as a useful piece of film, and honestly, some of the stuff that Gen 2 does is pretty damn close, I could then absolutely use that to sell it to the studio, or sell it to my producers and say, here's a version, here, one of the paths that I've gone down is this insert shot. We can tell the story, we can do the things you're asking for, but I think the missing piece is this insert shot, and here is an idea of what that might look like. And as Chad is saying, now all of a sudden we're not starting at zero. It's not just text on a screen saying, you know, insert shot of blah, blah, blah. You don't have to convince I don't know if, you know, you've ever struggled to get a studio or a network to imagine what it is you're pitching before you actually have the image of it. A lot of times having something that you can point to and say, no, this is kind of the gist of what we're looking for. Of course, it's going to be the good version of this. You know, that gets you a long way to solving that problem. You know, there's other generative AI technologies. Like, there's recently I found a piece of software that'll create stems from any music, right? So you're like, God, I love this song, but I wish I could pull the vocals out, yeah. Right? There's a really awesome piece of software out there right now that'll do that. You know, like, oh, this is fantastic, but I wish I could just use the drums at the beginning for the first 10 to 15 seconds and then bring in the whole, you know, yeah. This is the kind of stuff that you generally would have to go and ask your music supervisor to get the stems, and then you'd bring in the stems. I mean, it would take days. Now you can go down that path, as Tim would have said, like one of the paths is try to explore this musical editing choice. You can use this software to create stems. They're not perfect, but they're really, really good. This all brings me back to the idea that right now, and I think of artificial intelligence personally in three stages. And right now, I think we're in stage one. And that is that these tools they're increasing the capabilities and the creative tools and power of the storytellers. And it's incredible. I mean, it really is. It's so empowering. And it's creating new ways to get down a path. It's creating new ways to find paths. Stage one is really, really exciting because you still very much need a human being in the loop to say, this is good. This is a good choice, and this is a bad choice. But it just generates a bunch of interesting ideas. It creates a bunch of interesting ideas, and you can scroll through it and use that to riff onto something better, or you can, you know, you as an editor or as a creative, you can then start to use that to work with. You know, stage two is, I think, what a lot of people get to begin to, where, at least personally, I get concerned about artificial intelligence, which is when these models get so big that it begins needing human beings less and less in the loop. And I do think, I mean, you know, Zach, you're right. I don't think anyone can predict the future. With, you know, if somebody tells you what's coming, you should probably turn around and walk away from them, which means I really shouldn't be saying this. But I think that stage two in AI seems like it's coming down the path. And it's going to require less and less human interaction to say that's a good idea or not a good idea. Because the models will be big enough, and it's statistically going to be able to say, well, this is statistically really, like, you're going to look at it, and it's just going to work. Like, I don't know if you've used ChatGPT 3.4 versus ChatGPT 4, but it is significantly better. The model, the algorithm is better. It gives you good answers a lot more of the time.
And five's coming.
And honestly, and the thing is, it's going to be not like, oh, that made a that told a, you know, there's a couple nuggets of good stuff in there, and a lot of it's junk. It's going to be like, actually, this is all really, really solid. And I mean, you know, you may or may not need to do any adjustments. That's stage two that I think is both exciting and scary, because that's the wave phase beginning to pick up. And then, you know, the science fiction junkie in me, you know, the one who's making shows about spaceships and evil artificial intelligence machines. I mean, then at some point, you know, these same technologies are going to allow us to build artificial general intelligence. And personally, as a parent, I think about my kids and I think about the world they're going to live in, and I think about my own career, and I think about what impacts artificial general intelligence is going to have as distinct from generative AI. You know, and I think that's actually something that everybody, whether you're working in the film industry or you're just living on this planet, you should be considering it, because those are the window of time that we're going to be able to do things to affect how those outcomes are going to work out. That window will close at some point. We're in that window now.
Do you mind if I jump in here?
Go right ahead.
Anybody, you don't need to do this now, because I don't want you guys pulling out your phones. Pull out something that's called the Gartner Hype Cycle, G-A-R-T-N-E-R. What he just said about phase one, phase two, phase three. This is not the first time we've ever seen a major inflection point with technology. If you look up Gartner Hype Cycle, you're going to see that there's this graph where it goes up in stage one, massive amounts of hype about any new technology and how it's going to change everything. Then it drops all the way back down into this thing called the trough of despair. This is not what we thought it was. Things have changed in a totally different way. Then it slowly climbs up a slope that's called the slope of enlightenment. Oh, this isn't quite what we expected, but we're learning how to adapt to it. Guess where we are right now, right? We're at the top of this hype cycle. And I think that the thing that everybody's thinking, the elephant in the room, is not where do I fit into this workflow, or how does this tool work, or how does that tool work? It's, am I even going to have a job anymore? Is there anybody that this is the real reason you came to the panel today? Is I'm not even sure if I'm going to be needed. And first of all, I want to say I'm very supportive of a lot of the tools that are out there. I'm experimenting with them as well. So I want to come at what you had said from a slightly different angle, kind of slightly playing the devil's advocate. Where I had no idea there was an AI tool that builds stems out of music. Like, oh my God, how much would that change the world of editing a scene, right? So from our perspective, we're thinking, here's an amazing new tool that's going to help us be better editors. How do you think the composers in the room feel about this tool right now? If you were a composer in the room, you'd be like, that's what I do. That's my thing. And those were my cues. And I want you to come through me so I can create the stem. So now imagine giving the same speech that he was given, studio executive. Imagine the possibilities where I can just go to this AI tool and there's an edit button. The ability to tell stories has got vastly better. How do all of us feel about that right now? That's really what we're thinking about. So depending on the perspective that you're taking from this, as we, the storytellers, the editors, we're seeing all these different tools. If I'm a rotoscoping artist and I'm thinking about the rotoscoping tool that Runway ML has, if that's my one specialization, I'm in pretty big trouble right now.
Yeah.
Avid just recently, I don't know if they've released it. I know they've announced it, and I hope I don't get in trouble because I'm pretty sure it's public. But they have an AI version of ScriptSync that's coming. I think Michael's in the room, isn't he? He was at some point. So hopefully I'm not talking out of turn. But I remember hearing publicly that Avid is looking at AI ScriptSync. If the only thing that you do is ScriptSync manually, you're in really big trouble. So this is where I continue to talk about how generalizing your skill set and understanding how you can provide value as a more complex storyteller is so important, Because from our perspective on this panel, we're talking about all these new tools that make our lives better. But these tools that are making our lives better, there's somebody else that's saying, what about me? And now that wave is coming for all of us sooner than we think. So I think that's a bigger part of this conversation. But again, I support all of these advances. But if we look at it from another perspective, there are people that will listen to this conversation and they don't see opportunity. We're going to be a part of that conversation sooner than we know it, which is largely what's going on with the politics of the industry, which we're not going to go there. But I know that that's a big reason, you know, why we're following all of this.
For the group, if you are working in editorial in one of these areas that could change in the not too distant future, what additional skill sets or what sorts of things would you recommend from an education standpoint?
I guess I can start with this one, and then I think when it comes from the technology standpoint, the tools, this is definitely the better side of the panel for that. But what I work on with my students is identifying what are the skill sets that make us uniquely human, where I'm not worried about being replaced by technology anytime soon. And one of the reasons that I, at least as an editor, there's a lot more complexity to specialized skill sets in editing or rotoscoping or color. It's very complex. But as an editor, the reason I'm not worrying about being replaced anytime soon is one thing. It is the note underneath the note. Just imagine you have a cut and there's an edit button and an executive says, do these 10 notes. What a tremendous disaster that would be. It is our job to interpret the note and say, yeah, all this is really stupid. However, you kind of have a point, but the reason you think this doesn't work isn't this, it's actually this. So our ability to interpret the note underneath the note is the reason that I'm not worried. The reason that we can empathize with our characters, the reason that we have these things called mirror neurons, that as an editor, when I'm watching performances, I can tell the difference between take one, take two, take four, and take 10, and say, ooh, I felt something watching that facial expression that the actor didn't do in the others. AI is at a place where through facial recognition, it can say because the crick of the mouth was here instead of here, it might create this emotion, but it doesn't feel. It doesn't have empathy. As soon as AI can read the note underneath the note and it can empathize, we're in really big trouble. But I don't think we're anywhere close to that unless I just don't understand the technology. So that's why I'm not worried. So the skill sets, learning how to be more empathetic, learning how to solve complex problems, a really important one is going to be communication skills. And it's also going to be communicating with technology. There are going to be entire degrees on prompt engineering so we learn how to communicate with these tools. Because if I say, write me a funny script that's 5 pages, but I don't understand how to break down my prompts, the quality of my script is going to be very different. And I'm sure that Chris can speak to the prompt engineering of creating a better shot versus a worse shot. But I think one of the most important ones, and I know that we as editors and just creatives in general, that I think is so downplayed, is our ability to manage conflict and understand how to get the result and the vision that somebody wants. So if you want to go out and make yourself future-proof, get a degree in clinical psychology. You will be an editor for decades to come because AI is never going to figure that out.
So will the AI be able to negotiate with the director?
Yeah, exactly. But those are, when you get past a certain point in your career, that's what separates you from everybody else. This is not an AI conversation. This is always the way that it's been. When you're entering your career, yeah, you have to learn Avid or Premiere or ScriptSync or Google Sheets or whatever it is. There's a baseline of hard skill competency. If you don't know how to do these things, you can't do the job. Once you get to a certain level, everybody knows how to use those tools. It's your ability to extract the essence of you, your ability to make decisions. It's your opinions, your life experiences change what you think is the right shot versus what I think is the right shot. It's what you're bringing to the equation. It's your personality. It's your ability to communicate. That's why people hire you once you get past a certain level. AI is not going to change any of that, but we're going to have to diversify our ability to manage and communicate with completely different tools.
I have spent almost 10 years now raving about how much I love my Topomat, and I have finally discovered what I now consider the Topomat of desk chairs, the Core 360. The Core 360, spelled Q-O-R, is designed to keep me constantly moving while seated in an upright and balanced position. To learn more about how it works, let's hear from Core 360 founder, Dr. Turner Osler, about why he created the Core 360 active sitting chair.
When you sit badly for many hours a day, and that's really what the problem is. It's very hard to make yourself get up and do jumping jacks every half hour. But if you just swap to a chair that requires you to be muscularly engaged in order not to fall off, it's an easy bar to clear.
For the procrastinators out there who hear all of the statistics and know how bad sitting is and it's the new smoking and they're thinking, that's something I'll worry about in a few decades, you're gonna feel the effects of having more energy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 4 o'clock in the afternoon that day.
And that's the whole point. Your core muscles will be stronger, you'll have less back pain. All of this will make you more available for the rest of the pursuits of your life, your kids, your hobbies, your whatever.
For those of us who need to practically live in front of computers to do our best creative work, the Core 360 is going to level up your game. Keep your body moving and keep the creativity flowing. To learn more and purchase what I consider to be the topomat of desk chairs, please go to optimizeyourself.me/core360. That's optimizeyourself.me/QOR360.
Today, the next generation of film editors learn from, you know, assisting. They're in the cutting room. They're, you know, being mentored. Does the mentoring and training process for the next generation of creatives change with this? And if so, how? And anyone can jump on that.
Yeah, I'm worried about that. Honestly, because it
feels like it will.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real concern. I think that there's... I think one of the best things about the editor, assistant editor relationship, and like I was fortunate to have wonderful, generous mentors so that I could learn my craft enough so that I was employable. And then I got to a point where I could do the job well enough, and then I could start making mistakes. And then I would learn from each one of those mistakes. And I've made a lot of mistakes. I was looking at my pension and healthcare recently.
Why would you do that?
Well, there's a number in there. It was just a little north of 50,000 hours, right? So, I'm not ancient, but I've been editing professionally in the union for more than 50,000 hours, right? I mean, if 10,000 hours is mastery, and I'm still only 20% as quick as most people. Let's say I'm 20% of the average person. I probably got there. I don't mean to call myself a master, but I mean you do something for 50,000 hours, like you get decent at it. I understand exactly what you're saying about the note behind the note, right? I got there by making small mistakes and by experimenting and exploring paths. And I am both very excited. I mean, so scripting is a great example. As an assistant editor, part of the scripting process, as grueling as it is, you're going through the takes. You're watching the footage over and over again. And you are subconsciously or maybe very consciously deciding which you would choose. And that is critical to being a good editor. And I agree that artificial intelligence being used for scripting would be wonderful because so much time is spent doing that, and it would free that same assistant editor up for something else. But that same assistant editor then probably doesn't need to sit through the dailies. And if they choose not to, and they choose not to watch all of those choices and make their own decision as to what would be the right cut, and then see how the cut gets developed and say, I see why they chose that. I was going to go this way, but I see why they went that way. Or vice versa. Like, oh, they went that way, and that was the wrong choice. They missed out on all this great comedy, or they missed out on all this great drama. Like, the same tools that we're talking about that are so empowering and free up the assistant editor for all their free time, it's also taking away something really significant. And that is it's a concern, And I think as editors, I think one of our responsibilities to the next generation of people coming up is help them navigate that. Because, I recognize that, but the assistant editor that I'm working with next that's doing, auto scripting, I might say, like, I want you to watch every single piece of film, and I want you to, I just want you to go through it all, and I want you to take your own notes. And I'm going to need to, in order to make that assistant editor, to help them be in a position to get the job that they're striving for, I need to reach out and help them. And in the same way that I parent, you know, it's the trick is, you know, you want to encourage and challenge and engage, you know, and the problem with these AI tools is that I expect at some point some studio executive is going to say, well, we don't need all that scripting time now, so you probably could do it with one less assistant editor, right? You know, and then as an editor, it's going to be my job to stand up and say, no, it's really important that we keep that assistant editor in the loop and as part of the process. You know, that I need to creatively find ways for them to support me so that I can then go and explore more of the paths. And if I can come up with creative ways for that assistant editor to help support me come up with more exploration of the path to give the producers and the directors that I'm working with an even better product and in a slightly faster time frame, then that assistant editor has a role in the process. But you know, part of the onus is going to be on the editors to find creative ways to be supportive and to mentor that next generation, because these tools are, you know, they're going to give and they're going to take, and they do now. You know?
As soon as you said mentorship, I'm going to have to prevent myself from doing an entire TED Talk, because mentorship is a huge, huge passion of mine, I think, as many people here already know. And I want to bring both Chris and Chad into this conversation. One of the concerns that I have with the technology is that especially those that are coming up that are younger, there are going to be a lot of different. I don't think they're going to have the same opportunities to learn and grow, where it's like, well, you know, we don't need as many assistant editors and technology can do the work. I'm not as concerned about that. One of the reasons being, and this is where I think understanding that mentorship is a two-way street is so important. I think that right now with disruption, there's a tremendous opportunity for the people that are younger that are coming up. And that's working with the curmudgeons like me that don't want to learn and change. When I was younger in this industry, I was learning Final Cut 7 and I was learning After Effects and I wanted to know all the new tools so I could be valuable to the editors on my team and I could work with directors and producers. I don't want to learn anything anymore. I just want to come to work and I want to work in Avid 2018 and they changed my windows. Why did they change the colors? I liked it that way, right? There's a tremendous opportunity for mentorship because I want to hire and work with assistant editors that know the new language, that know prompt engineering, where I say, I don't want to make the insert shot. Can you just tell Runway ML what I want and they can mentor me? So I don't know, is Dodie Dorn in here by any chance? I know she was here. Obviously, she was here earlier on a panel. She's not here anymore, but I did a podcast conversation with her where she was my very first mentor. I reached out to her, literally sent her a handwritten letter, found her address on Yahoo, you know, address search 20 plus years ago. She reached out. She became my editing mentor. But then something changed about 10 years ago when I had started what was at the time Fitness and Post and is now Optimize Yourself. She read one of my articles and she was really blown away by this idea of I should treat myself better than my technology. And she went and anybody that knew Dodie more than 10 years ago, if you saw her today, you're like, where'd the rest of you go? I mean, she looks fantastic. And she reached out to me and she said, you've been a mentor to me. So if you're thinking mentor-mentee relationships is I'm super experienced and I know everything and I'm here and I know nothing and I teach you, this is a two-way street. So if you really want to become valuable and you want to learn, I think there's a ton of opportunity for younger people to learn these technologies and teach it to people like us. So I wanted to bring it to the two of you to help me understand how could somebody here that wants to be valuable to me learn these tools if I really don't want to learn them?
How can we make you learn it? No, it's interesting.
It's not so much how can augment the fact that I just want to keep doing.
I mean,
my
if we're
thing.
Talking about the fresh generation, this is where I think it's funny to me and exciting also as well, because when I started and finished school, I was starting at USC and then I decided to switch and go into acting and direction and theater and went to study in London. And in a way, that was probably one of the most valuable decisions for me because it actually took me out of this comfort zone of this task or this one kind of craft, if you will, and it allowed me to put myself on a stage with nothing around me and learn how to actually direct a performance or even try to give a performance. And to me, that was so valuable in a way where it's like I don't know how my career would have changed or how my life would have changed if I didn't have that general knowledge. And I think it was back literally to what you said in the very beginning, which is general knowledge is so important. The other thing I think is fascinating about this world is that the speed at which you can create, and I do agree, yeah, that you do need things to gest it. You need things to like let it breathe and let it sleep on it and so forth. But I do find it's fascinating that a young student today coming out might have an entire career. My 30-year career could be done in 10 years in terms of the same output with these tools. And to me, that means they're making more, they're given a chance to take more risks, to make more mistakes, and to hopefully find their own sense of art and their own voice in a faster period of time, and maybe in a way where it allows them to even find that, define their voice even stronger than in the current system. And to me, that's actually interesting and exciting, because I don't know what new filmmakers from around the world that might emerge, or storytellers, with these tools. Through the old system, they might be eliminated. They might even get more no's than they ever get that chance to actually make something. So, whereas these tools might actually allow them to make something that actually gets them seen and discovered sooner, and then allow them to continue to do so even further. I don't know. That's where it's interesting to me. But to your point, general knowledge, you know, human interaction, take yourself out of just, I mean, I don't want to say take yourself out of the editing room and get into the real world. But I mean, there is a part of that where, human interaction is the whole essence of this collaborative creative community. And these AI tools just, they're not being taught that part of it. I mean, they're able to give you results, don't get me wrong. But that collaboration is just so essential. And so I hope the schools, and I know we've talked about this, USC is specifically, it's just like, that needs to really be almost the fundamental foundation looking ahead, because the tools will always change and the tools will get better. But it's that collaborative creative spirit that we really got to teach, and that general knowledge.
Yeah. If we're talking about these core skills, communicating your vision. Yeah. That's what filmmaking has been since the beginning of the film camera, communicating a vision. We're just using different tools and different modes of communication. That's still a generalized skill. Like, for me, there have been so many, like, great moments from today's panels. The one that stuck with me the most was when Evan Schiff was talking about the stunt coordination for John Wick 3. And he said, they didn't just learn the moves, they learned jiu-jitsu. Yeah. So that if they had to change the move or work around a column or something else, it wasn't a matter of, oh, I don't understand that move. Their brain had a generalized knowledge of how jiu-jitsu worked, so they could pivot, right? And it's the difference between I have this one skill set versus I have this generalized knowledge. And that's really the approach here. And I guess I'm putting my podcaster hat on. I'm sorry. I get into this mode. Go ahead.
Well, what I do want to do is we do want to allow a little bit of time for Q&A, because I'm sure we have a lot of questions. So please raise your hands, and I think we might have a mic. Yes. Right here we have a question.
Yeah, this question is for Chad. I think you mentioned that the longest part of your project was getting the voice actors. Today you have like companies like 11 Labs that allows you to do voice cloning, add emotion. Yeah. If you do it today, would you be using that?
I mean, I've used that for sometimes inserts or even thinking about like, let's try something. But I still am, I love the idea of working with artists and the idea of just completely replacing the artist, especially the life that a performer will bring or an actor will bring to a performance, I think is so essential. I find that a lot of those tools just feel like maybe first or second table reads at best. They just don't have that spark. They don't have that energy. Now, granted, that'll come. I think that's where it's going to be very interesting for interactivity. So for things, you know, future video games and those types of applications where those, you know, you'll be able to talk to your favorite characters and exist in their world and have dynamic conversations as opposed to just script trees. But I think for linear media and storytelling, they're good, but I still find that it's not even remotely close to that performance than the surprise you get with working with talent.
And for Zach, same question is for generalizing for voice actors, if this tool gets to the point where you can't tell the difference between a human actor and a voice or a digital actor. In voice-wise, how do they generalize? What do they do there?
Well, the first thing I want to, and I'll answer the question, but I think we could easily do an entire panel, if not an entire day, on the ethics of AI. Mm-hmm. This is a conversation I've been having with my team a lot, where we're experimenting with ChatGPT and all these different models and building second brains, and we're having fun and really learning what they're capable of. But one of the things I told my team, there's some blog post or newsletter that I wrote, one of my team members used Midjourney, which is similar, it's a generative AI, similar to what DALL-E or Runway did. And they said, we think this would be a great thumbnail. And I said, absolutely not. So there's no way I'm releasing a piece of content knowing that that content was generated using the art of other human beings, right? I want to learn how the technology works and what it's capable of. But if I'm putting it out into the world, it's not going to be generative because there's ethics behind it. I'm not going to release a newsletter or a blog post that's written by ChatGPT unless it's an experiment. I actually sent out an outreach message that was written to Eddie Hamilton, the editor of Top Gun, displaying here's how I wouldn't write an outreach message. And I got a whole bunch of feedback. And then I told everybody, by the way, ChatGPT wrote this message. I didn't. They're like, whoa, like I didn't realize it could write something. You didn't know it wasn't human, right? So I guess the first thing I would say is that, like Chad, I would use this stuff all day long to play around with it. If I were going to actually use it, I would not use it unless I were working with human beings, because there's an element of nuance and emotion and feeling that you don't get from these tools. So I guess for me, other than an exploratory tool, I wouldn't see myself using 11 Labs. But if I'm somebody like a voice actor and I'm thinking, this is all that I do as I do voices, then 11 Labs could potentially change what I do. I would be asking myself the question, what's the deeper reason that I'm a voice actor or that I'm a performer? What's the emotion that I want to create for people, and what am I uniquely good at? Do I do voice acting where it's, you know, fun, happy children stuff because I had that energy? Is it that I can do something really dark and brooding? What is the energy or the emotion that I'm uniquely good at creating? I guarantee you can do that in other areas other than just voiceover. Like the world of audiobooks, that's going bye-bye. Like audiobooks are going to be largely done by AI, but that doesn't mean you can't use your voice as a talent. Think about what's the essence of what I do that I can apply in other areas. That's how I would look at it.
I would say just, you know, keep an ear to the ground on it because it's changing so fast right now. Jenny.
This question is for Cristobal. Obviously, we're all creatives looking to you, like you are, know what's coming. What kinds of questions do you have for us, the creative editors?
That's a great question. What are you all really excited about in terms of using this technology? I think I've seen answers to these questions with experts here. I think as something I keep reflecting on, I think a theme of the conversation has been around tools. We're speaking about tools and how we use these tools. Don't obsess with the tools, obsess with what are you getting out of them. And perhaps a good way of making sense for me of change is to look at the past, because I think the past has a lot of insights as to what's going to happen in the future. And really the reason why we're here is because 150 years ago, a group of scientists from all over the world started playing with optics and with light and with engineering and came up with a camera. And then someone had the idea of stitching images together to create moving pictures. And this is the reason why we're here 150 years after that. It would have been impossible in the late 1800s to think about us being here, speaking about everything we're speaking about at that time, right? Because the craft about art and storytelling was painting. Everything was done via a paintbrush. And so painting was the medium, it was the thing. Photography wasn't taken seriously because it didn't work as it works now. And film was like not even like in the realm of what we thought could be something so serious that we could build entire industries and jobs and worlds around it. Even the Lumières, early on, they created like the first 10 films. They thought like, oh, this is going nowhere. Like, it's not going to work. It doesn't matter. And I think the lesson from me there is really to, first of all, embrace and understand that it's very hard, as we were saying before, predicting the future. Like, predicting those changes, the magnitude of that change, was just really hard because it all happened in a few years with a few innovations, with a few changes. And so really embracing that and being like, if we're all probably here like painters, we're like holding paintbrushes and the camera is about to be invented or almost was invented. So in the 1910s, first 1900s, and think about it from that perspective, like we're in the black and white, really raw, like big camera ages of cinema. And then everything will come after it will be us collectively experimenting with this technology and then inventing things like visual effects. Like visual effects was just people like experimenting with taking cinema like forward and forward and forward. And so more than questions, perhaps an invitation could be like embrace, as I think a lot of you already are, an experiment. Because what we need right now is people that can look at the technology, not from my kind of like position, which is research and engineering and like putting it out, but really from an artistic perspective. And just like pushing yourself to, okay, how can I use this? And how can I make it so that we come up with things that we're not even like thinking about right now? And that's how I guess a good sense and a good like direction I would do is just embrace and experiment.
I don't know who to direct it at, but I am fascinated with the tools, but I'm also fascinated with how the tools work. I have to assume that a lot of this AI is database driven. Correct?
I'm happy to take that. Database, they models use data sets. And so they use data sets to understand patterns within data. And this is there's a subfield of AI that's all the rave right now called deep learning. And deep learning is a subfield of machine learning. And in that subfield, generative AI is the reason why we're mostly here. That field in particular uses data to train and understand patterns. So, I guess to answer your question, there's this idea of a data set that gets feeds into the models.
So the tool's only kind of as good as the database?
Tools are always as good as the data set.
Who controls the database?
It depends, because models are not trained equally. Like, for example, we're talking about the rotoscoping tool. That's a tool that we've created that allows you to select objects in a shot, and it will like automatically create a segmentation map or a mask. There's no data set around segmentation. I guess there is because it might be scattered around different like editors might have the before and after shots of the shots you rotoscope. But it doesn't exist like a library of sorts where you can just feed on. So when we're thinking about kind of like how do we solve that problem of making rotoscoping really quick, we had to invent a data set. So the way we invented that data set was start collaging videos together. Of different objects and recording like a green screen. We tried so many different methods. And so that data set didn't exist. We have to come up with the data set. And so all models are trained differently because the task around the models and the thing you're trying to do depends and might be different. And so I guess to answer your question, it depends.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
It feels like the database is going to become a commodity at some point.
I think models will become the commodities, like the outputs. And you'll see this with language models these days, where like ChatGPT was like, oh, the rave, but there are models now that are coming and coming really close, which I think it's the rate of progress. Like, again, if we go back to thinking about this as a new camera, cameras are sort of a commodity. Like, you have a camera in your phones, right? But what makes you a filmmaker is not that you have a camera. Like, you're not going to press record and you're going to be like, great, where's my Oscar? Like, I'm a filmmaker, right? Like, this is the same, right? You can get a camera anywhere, but the craft of filmmaking is a craft. You need to understand how to use it, you need to iterate, you need to experiment. And so if models becomes commodity and everyone gets access to all these video, language, audio models, that's great. But to tell a story, you need more than just the tool. You need to know how to use the tool. And so models, I think, will become commodities.
Yeah, the one thing I would say, I feel like the industry so far has been based off of just general knowledge of models or data sets that have either one, the worst, been just scraped across the internet, just, you know, haphazardly, or they've been trained on licensed content, where like Adobe, for example, is saying they're only training on licensed content. I think the next phase, I mean, if I were to add like a 1.5 tier three stages, the next phase is going to be Disney Corporation or Paramount or Toyota Motor Corp can say, we have so much information that we own, and we want to train these models only on our information, and no one else in the world will see that training data in the kind of the generic models. And so as in, like, let's just say Star Trek, John's world, he will have the most perfect, if you will, or the most knowledgeable Star Trek, basically LLM or, you know, language model as well as generative data set that can create as close as it can create perfectly to, you know, someone hand drawing or someone photographing it, but no one else at a different studio would be able to see or access that information. I think that's about where we're on the verge of that. And I think that starts to change, again, some of the nature of generic data sets versus IP that a company or a corporation or an individual owns.
There's a great book that I finished a little while back called The Creativity Code by, his last name is De Savoy. But one of the experts in the book, it talks about Deep Blue playing chess against Apple's or against Google's DeepMind, and I think it's a really, for me, it was a very impactful bit of story, because really it always comes back to story, right? Most people remember when Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov. I think it was like 1998, and no computer was ever going to be able to beat the greatest chess players in the world, and of course they did. That same algorithm, that same machine, Deep Blue, continued to evolve. And so by 2016, that was a fantastically powerful chess-playing juggernaut. I mean, that Deep Blue creation was the Godzilla of chess. Google's, and I'm remembering a book, so I mean, my details are probably wrong, but I highly recommend it. It's called The Creativity Code. Google's DeepMind, which had never been trained to play chess, but was using, I think it was like a Monte Carlo algorithm. Basically, it used a neural net algorithms to understand chess, as opposed to just understanding a giant data set. It had a new way of looking at the data that it had. It was a much weaker computational system, but it had a different way of looking at the data. I mean, I think the example they gave in the book was that Deep Blue could project 20 million chess moves in any given direction at any given time. DeepMind, on the other hand, could project 70,000. That kind of gives you perspective on the amount of computing power. When they put DeepMind and Deep Blue head-to-head, and again, Deep Blue or DeepMind, the Google's AI-based system, had never played chess. They just gave it the basic parameters of what is a win and what is a loss. It took 4 hours to destroy Deep Blue and to become unbeatable. That, for me, my takeaway to your question is, in that instance, it's not about the data set as much as it's about how that data is processed. As an editor, that particular story, I mean, I don't know that it really pertains to your question, but it makes me concerned and excited about something that could, you know, if DeepMind can turn its attention to chess and become unstoppable in 4 hours, what an amazing tool that could be for me in the cutting room, and also what a terrifying adversary that would be in the hands of the studio trying to make me less involved in the process.
Something like chess, which to us is incredibly complex, really easy for technology to figure out because it's all permutations and computations, and what are the 20 million different variables or the 70,000. What AI has a really hard time with is things like, how does a human walk? Driving, right? Still haven't figured out auto driving. They're trying to figure it out. How do we feel things? How can we predict human emotions? So even though to us it's like, oh my God, if it can figure out chess, we're in big trouble. There's actually a lot of reasons that we're not in as much trouble as we think. And again, I don't understand neural networks and I don't understand the technology, but I understand the implications because I read so much about this like you have, and I'm already like, ooh, creativity code, got to get the author on my podcast, right? But at the end of the day, I've heard like the world's experts on this say that we think if they can do chess, they can do everything. It's way easier for AI to figure out chess than it is to figure out humans. So don't think that it's all doom and gloom because of that. And if I'm speaking out of turn, you let me know.
Our next question.
Hi. As an assist who's actually leaned more into the AI side of things to help with stems and titles and all those things like that, it's hard not to feel with the way technology's going with remote work and more monotonous work being covered by AI, that the mentor-mentee, aspect of being an assistant editor is really struggling. I mean, I'm seeing a lot more of it's being more of a funnel in terms of like the number of assistants needed, yeah, and, you know, even just having that personable face-to-face, you know, communication with editors. I mean, what could you say that would assure, you know, an assistant editor that, you know, like even with, you know, being up to date with the technology and being up to date with AI, that, you know, studios aren't just going to see you as an extra paycheck that they can do without, you know, because there's things that, you know, even editors won't have a say with, you know, when it comes down to finances.
Yeah,
you know?
The first thing is we're all paychecks to the studio. Like, if you're thinking something's going to change, like, oh, now we're a commodity and it's all about the numbers and what about the art? It's never been about the art. We've always been a paycheck and we've always been a light item. That's never going to change. They're just going to see technology giving them more of an opportunity to save more money. So if we're thinking that's changing, it's always been that way. I tend to be overly optimistic, and sometimes I have to be brought down. So I may look back at this in a year and say, that didn't age well. I think there's actually a tremendous opportunity for there to be more mentorship. Because what I've seen over the transition from film to digital, and I've talked to a lot of other more seasoned editors that were in the film days, where there was a lot more mentorship, then technology came along, and I'm sure many assistant editors can speak to, their job is just data management. I'm just doing all these rote tasks and doing all the metadata, and I'm doing the spreadsheets and all these other things. I actually think there's an opportunity for the creative mentorship to have more space and time if we set boundaries with our schedules and with our budgets. This is a contract conversation that I'm not going to get into, but I actually think that as long as it's not a matter of, well, we don't need the assistants anymore because we have the AI to do it, that to me is a different conversation. Let's assume that the jobs remain and we can protect them through contracts or boundaries or whatever are necessary. I think AI actually creates a tremendous opportunity for more creative mentorship than we've seen since film transitioned to digital. But again, this might not age well. I don't know. But that I want to assume the more optimistic version because I don't want to think about the alternative. I just want to prepare for it just in case.
Okay, so I'm afraid, although we could talk about this for hours, we do have to wrap up. So I hope what you took away from this is we really don't know what's going to happen other than that there's going to be change. But hopefully we gave you some things to think about. Please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thank you so much for investing both your time and energy listening to today's show. If you were inspired by this conversation, don't forget to subscribe in your podcast app of choice, and most importantly, leave a review, because that helps move the show to the top of iTunes and get our message out there to those who need it the most. Simply visit optimizeyourself.me/subscribe to never miss another episode. Lastly, stay safe, healthy, sane, and most importantly, be well. One last thing before I lose you. If you haven't already, I want to make sure that you've subscribed to my free weekly Case of the Mondays newsletter, because it is where I share my best advice, strategies, and mindsets to help you design a creative career that you absolutely love showing up for every Monday morning. When you sign up, I'm even going to send you a bonus 5-day email course to help you clarify and prioritize the next small steps in your unique path to success. To sign up, just visit optimizeyourself.me/newsletter, and I will see you in your inbox.